Many students who attend community college are non-traditional students who likely didn't take a lot of college prep courses.
Here they are at a community college, hoping that they can kind of get on track to achieve their dreams.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about a new book exploring solutions for community college teachers. We'll also hear how the military is gaming up and spend an academic minute with a new way to build houses. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Most students whose high school career was all about college preparation don't end up in community college. That means teachers at community colleges have challenges that university instructors likely don't even think about. Getting past those challenges is the topic of Felicia Darling's new book, Teaching It: Breakout Moves That Break Down Barriers for Community College Students. Dr. Felicia Darling is an education researcher and longtime community college math teacher. We talked about why she took on the project and who this book is aimed at.
Yeah, so I took on the project. I felt like the book was writing itself in the back of my mind for a few years here. And it just, I feel like, honestly, it chose me to write this book. And it sounds kind of cheesy, I know, but it's just the way it was. What are you going to do? And I wrote the book because I really feel like I could make a difference for students who are underrepresented among those with four-year degrees. I am a first-generation college student, and I've taught at the community college and high school level for a long time. And as we know, there's certain groups of students who are just underrepresented among those with bachelor's degrees, students of colors, students from the LGBTQ+ community, first-generation college students, students with disabilities, students from poorer backgrounds like I was. And so I wrote the book because I believe this book can be a game changer for those students. But the book is not directed towards those students. The book is directed towards the instructors of those students, specifically community college instructors and other professors who teach at more open access colleges. I'm hoping, my goal is to reach those instructors and give them some of the research behind some great practices, some powerful practices, and also introduce some practices that work for me and other instructors who are interviewed for the book. And I put some comics in there to try to kind of bring the research alive through practices and examples and students and teachers' stories.
Do community college teachers face special challenges that, say, a four-year university teacher wouldn't?
Yes, for sure. I mean, obviously, higher percentages of students who are underrepresented among those with four-year degrees show up at community colleges from widely diverse backgrounds. And also, they have really quite a variety of gaps in knowledge because a lot of these students were not thinking they were going to a four-year college. A lot of students are returning. So there's quite a range of students that show up at community college, and they weren't the students in California, they call them A through G requirements. They didn't necessarily take a college prep program. So here they are at a community college, you know, hoping that they can kind of get on track to achieve their dreams, but they also, are in a classroom with other people who may not be prepared for a four-year university. So, you know, I don't want to be deficit talk about it. So community colleges is a certain group of students, though. They're the students who weren't, you know, directed towards a university, right? And there's quite a variety. I have students in my class, for example, some who have a GED, some who don't even have a GED, some who've had some college classes 10 years ago and are back, some who are right out of high school. It's quite a range of ages and socioeconomic factors and experiences that students bring to community college. It's really cool in that way. And it also means, though, that students might have some a variety of gaps in knowledge.
You talk in the book about teachers taking an education psychology course. What are these courses and why are they important?
Yeah, so at the community college, unlike in K through 12, people are certified to teach, right? So they've had a lot of education courses, and they've had some of those foundational theory courses, right? How students learn, how you can tap into how students learn in order to maximize teaching, like knowing that students really need to, you know, tap into their prior knowledge to really maximize their learning potential or optimize their learning potential. And those are some of the foundational education theory that persists today. They've actually, some of them are from the turn of the century, Piaget or Vygotsky's zone of proximal development. That's probably boring to some readers for me to even say that. But there's some really foundational ed psych theory that community college instructors don't necessarily have, because the requirement for community college, for instance, is sometimes just a master's in the content, in the discipline. But a lot of university professors maybe haven't had ed psych theory either.
So what does ed psych do?
So educational psychology theory is like the foundation upon which learning, you know, your understanding of how people learn is built. It's like understanding neuroscience or cognitive science. It's like, how do people learn, right? What are some fundamental things that are really important? Like, for instance, I want to think of something that's like this. I'll just go with Vygotsky's zone of proximal development, okay? If you're taking a class and what the teacher is saying is so far outside of where you are as a learner, they might as well just be speaking a completely different language, because you're not going to learn anything. However, if they can set up a classroom so that you show up and you're like, oh, I can kind of reach for what they're saying, and they're scaffolding the learning so I can get there in this classroom when it's set up this way, then you can move towards learning. If you're not in that learning zone, you're instead in this panicked zone, they call it like a reach zone, like where you're just outside your learning zone, then you really won't learn anything. You'll just be too anxious or too shut off. That's an example of ed psych theory.
So it's basically trying to figure out how your individual students take in the information.
Yeah, it's knowing that. It's going into classes that and build. So, for instance, I build on students' prior knowledge. I'm going to set up a classroom that does that because I know that's fundamental to them being able to learn. Maybe someone who hasn't had ed psych theory, they're like, wait, what do you mean you tap into prior knowledge? Is that important? You know, so it is a kind of important thing for instructors to know about. It's foundational to teaching in general, and every instructor in K-12 has had that course.
Very early in the book, you talk about asset-based instruction. What is asset-based instruction?
Okay, so asset-based instruction is like strengths-based instruction. As you know, many students of color and a lot of students who walk through life every day are subjected to, you know, discrimination and racism, or discrimination on the basis of their gender preferences. So there's a lot of discrimination floating out there. And so when you're in the classroom, what you want to do is build on students' strengths, right? You want to acknowledge that students come to college with different wells of cultural knowledge and different backgrounds from which to draw. But they also come with different gaps in knowledge. And so active learning is asset-based learning, or strength-based learning, because it's setting up learning so that students are able to draw from these different wells of cultural knowledge and build on their strengths and their prior knowledge, right? So instead of a student coming in and you're like, this is how you learn. I'm the authority in the room. Math is the authority. You're going to learn this way. You set it up so they can learn from where they're at, and they can build on what they already know to inch their way towards a deeper understanding. And they're also engaging in these conversations with other people. So all these different students, these learners, are building upon their prior knowledge, building upon their strengths, and drawing from these wells in order to build understanding together, to deepen their conceptual understanding of the material. So that's really asset-based learning, where you have a great group-worthy task and people can start at where they're at and build on what they know to get where you want them to be, to move towards the deeper conceptual understanding that you hope for them. And that's what's basically, that's my definition of asset-based instruction and strength-based instruction.
And you mentioned the group right there, and throughout the book, you put real importance on group-based projects.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, and you know, people call it active learning, they call it inquiry-based learning, project-based learning. But the idea is that you're bringing students together in groups to build on their prior knowledge to deepen their conceptual understanding. And so there's a lot of interaction, there's a lot of discussion. It's a lot harder for the instructor because they're having to facilitate conversations and do these probing questions like, oh, group number one, what are your assumptions when you're coming up with this answer? And it's a big shift when you're doing group instruction, group learning, facilitating that. It's a big shift away from correct answers to the process. So it's a lot harder way to teach because you're having to keep track of so many moving parts. And it requires you to invest a lot early on in co-developing norms around group work and building a community of powerful learners. So you're always trying to kind of cultivate or foster these connections with the students, this competency. You're trying to impress upon them that all students' voices are heard, and you're really doing a lot of moves in any moment, basically equity moves, to make the instruction more inclusive and to really facilitate this learning in this highly dynamic environment. That's group learning.
Still to come, our conversation with Felicia Darling continues with a look at 21st century learning. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Felicia Darling, an education researcher and longtime community college math teacher. We're talking about her new book, Teaching It: Breakout Moves That Break Down Barriers for Community College Students. In the book, she talks about 21st century learning. So I asked who was more prepared and advanced for the 21st century, students or teachers?
Sometimes, like students like me and you, went to school where you sat in a row and people told you what to do and you filled out worksheets in math class. So I actually, some of my students are still back there. That's how they learn. They didn't go through the Common Core and they're still learning. They have the same model of learning and instruction as I do. So in some ways, I'm ahead of them. I read the neuroscience. I'm aware of the cognitive science. I understand that productive struggle, working in groups and working hard like that is a better approach. I mean, I'm aware of the research. The research shows that this active learning, hands down, is better than just strict lecture instruction. Students do better in the next course. There's a lot of studies on that. And in fact, one study just came out that showed that although active learning is better, students know more after an active learning class than a lecture-based class, and they do better in the next class, students still think they're not learning as much. So I would have to say, because students still went through this, you know, kind of typical direct instruction K through 12 environment, that they're behind, at least in my classes, I have to actually do a little PR. That's what the studies are showing. We have to do a little PR if we're doing active learning to convince students that this is the best approach. Because they're frowning the whole time. It's hard work for the students. They are engaged in productive struggle the entire time. I would say until students in K through 12 have a lot more of these experiences, they're actually a little bit thinking this isn't the best approach. That's what I'm noticing. So there's a little bit of convincing. They can see that it's egalitarian. They can see that there's a community of learners, and they love that. And I think people who are usually marginalized can feel like you've disrupted more systemic inequities at the classroom level. That they can feel. That's a tone. But actually asking them, do you think you learn more this way or with direct instruction, they actually think they learn more with direct instruction, even though research is clear that they don't.
One thing I kind of hooked on in the book was when you talked about praising skills and not ability. That's a pretty subtle difference there, isn't it?
It really is. And that's pretty clear with Bowler's work, Joe Bowler, and also Carol Dweck's work, this idea that You want to shift the focus away from correct answers, like, oh, you're so smart at math. That's ability. That's praising a fixed ability. And also, oh, you get the answer right. Oh, what do you guys, instead of asking students, what'd you get for that answer? You give them tasks where there's multiple answers and you say, so how did you get that answer? What were your assumptions? What were you thinking when you did that? So it's just a shift towards process so people can identify errors and kind of celebrate them and embrace them and go, oh, I made an error. Now I know what to focus on. There's a radical shift, right, towards the process where it's okay to make mistakes. That's part of the learning process. Instead of like, oh, you've made a mistake. I guess you don't get this. That's the fixed mindset, right? The language I use in classes, I shift the focus on skills, you know, away from the correct answer towards skills. So, oh, you don't have the skills yet to complete that particular type of problem, or you're building the skills to complete, to solve that type of problem. So that's still focusing on process and in this case, skills. But of course, I teach math. It might be slightly different than another subject, like writing. Writing might have a different way of talking about the process rather than the correctness of a particular or the end goal of a particular work or piece that someone's working on.
Yeah, I know my math teachers never gave me questions that had more than one answer.
Yeah, Joe Bowler gives a specific example, and it's in the book, that idea of you can give someone a worksheet that says calculate the area of 40 rectangles, or you can give them a really great activity that has more than one answer that looks something like this. Each group, draw as many rectangles as you can with an area of 24. And that's a radical shift. That's shifting from that direct instruction, fill out a worksheet, towards a group-worthy task that has multiple answers. And then when the different groups come up with multiple answers, some come up with 8 rectangles, some draw an infinite amount of rectangles, you then get to talk about approaches. What approach did you take? What assumptions are you making? And that particular task is a great example of how, depending on what a student knows or doesn't know they bring into class, they can start that task somewhere.
So let's kind of speculate a bit on the future of community colleges themselves. Is it going to be a place for academics where it's just a stop to a 4-year university, or is it going to be focusing more on career training and getting them out into the world?
Well, I'm completely against the commodification of education or the privatization of education, like in the privatization of prison and the corporatization of education. So I'm against that philosophically. I'm biased against that. So when I hear that people just want to use community colleges to kind of like this factory business model, put students in, get them out as fast as they can, I'm kind of against that. I feel like since the community college serves a disproportionately large number of students of color, first generation college students, immigrants, students who are lower income, I feel like those students deserve to have the same freedom as anyone who goes through university to explore and get a liberal arts education and not, like, I feel it's deficit thinking to start talking about, let's put them in as fast as we can. Let's start counting graduation rates and let's put people in pathways, students in pathways. I feel like these students deserve to take time too. They also deserve to go through as fast as they want to in order to have, you know, a degree so they can disrupt their cycle of poverty if that's what they're in, and just change their lives. But I also think we need to be careful about community colleges just becoming kind of a mill or a factory. Although with AB 705 in California, they've shortened the pathway for students because they feel like students are getting too stuck in developmental classes and taking them for too long. And that's also discriminatory practice. So I think it's a balance, right? You don't want to hold students back in developmental classes, but you also, I think, don't want to take choices away from them by saying, you're going to hurry up and go through here, you're going to graduate, and colleges will be judged on how quickly they churn people through. Because I'm a first generation college student, and it took me a long time to get my degree. I got a PhD from Stanford in 2016. What was I, 54 or something? Would I really liked it better if they placed me in community college and placed me in a pathway and churned me out there? And I was an actuary in 2 years. I'm not sure. I feel like that's a little insulting to my quest for my own journey to find, you know, what I wanted to become. So I don't know. I feel a little bit, I have mixed feelings about that whole idea.
Well, in the end, what do you hope teachers or potential teachers take away from this book?
I hope that it's a hard model, okay? This inquiry-based model where you're layering in college skills and you're exploring your implicit bias and, you know, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. And I hope that teachers who didn't have the advantage of going to a 5-year PhD program but are still hungry to like serve these students who are at the community college and really want to redress those systemic inequities at the classroom level, I hope they find a lot of practical strategies, a lot of research that they can put into action in their own classroom. I hope that you know, and I'm seeing this, you know, some instructors are really loving the book because they didn't know about this idea, or they didn't know about stereotype threat, or they didn't know how to foster a growth mindset classroom, you know, with an equity lens. They didn't know about that stuff. So I'm seeing people get excited and inspired, and I want people to try things and figure out on their own self how they can be their best disruptor of systemic inequities at the classroom level at a community college. I'm hoping that's what people walk away with, a lot more power and competency to really bolster the success of the students who enter their classrooms.
Again, the name of Felicia Darling's book is Teaching It, Breakout Moves That Break Down Barriers for Community College Students. As the Army works to reach its recruiting goals, it's found that replacing on-campus recruiters with video games is one of the best ways to attract new soldiers. Increasingly, the military is holding e-sports events, and it's finding they're often more effective than traditional recruiting methods like visiting high schools or sending out brochures. From Denver, Taylor Allen reports for the American Homefront Project.
Call of Duty Modern Warfare is one of the most anticipated video game releases of the fall.
The rules of engagement have changed.
The game leads players through military missions and combat.
If you can't identify the target, you are the target.
So, it makes sense that Army recruiters pick this game to be the centerpiece of a recent recruiting event at an esports arena in Lakewood, a suburb outside of Denver. It's a dark room the size of a warehouse, lit mainly by the glow from rows and rows of computer screens. The people playing wear headphones. You hear the excited chatter of players and controllers clicking. Anyone who came to the game's release party was able to play the new game, as long as they also spoke to Army recruiters.
This is the targeted, you know, demographic, you know, these young men and women that come out here to play the esports.
Sergeant Vincent Cruz is a recruiter. He says video games are a way for the Army to connect with more people. It even started a professional esports team, which has become part of his pitch.
Reach out to these men and women and show them actually, hey, you can actually do this in the Army and get paid, by the way.
The Army has been struggling to attract new soldiers. Last year, it fell 6,000 troops short of its national recruiting goal. This year, the Army set a lower goal and met it. But Crew says the old ways to attract potential recruits just aren't working the way they used to.
Phone calls and, you know, text messages is not, you know, the way to go. Traditionally, that's how we've been trying to reach out to the population. For here, it's very difficult, you know what I mean? So now it's more like the Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat.
The Army says it's opened 44 virtual recruiting stations that are trying to reach potential soldiers through social media and text. And it calls its esports efforts some of the highest lead-generating events in the history of the all-volunteer force.
Do it! No, it's ah!
Across the gaming arena, 17-year-old Gavin Gaines is sitting at one of the computers staring at the bright screen. How is he doing so far?
I've died like 4 times in 3 missions, so not going to say greatest.
Gaines says he isn't ready for college yet, and he's about 95% sure he wants to go to the military. A big reason for him is community.
It's always just kind of been a big motivator for me, is just kind of like having somewhere where I belong. I like the military because it's like, you may not even necessarily like everyone, but it's like, you know, they have your back type of thing.
Out of about 110 people that attended the esports event, the military says it gained 35 leads. Michelle Alcantar is also 17 and a brand new recruit. She'll graduate in December, and by the summer, she's off to boot camp in Oklahoma. She got into video games through her brother-in-law, who's also in the Army. Call of Duty is a favorite. Both gaming and the military are stereotypically guy things, but she's proud to be a woman doing both of them.
To me, it's really special because not a lot of women, I feel like, are represented in the Army, and I feel like it's such a power move for women just because, like, we can do the same thing men can, and we're finally allowed to do that after I know that years that we couldn't.
Alcantar also ended up winning a raffle that night. She went home with a copy of the new game for Xbox, but she didn't say whether she'll take it to boot camp with her. In Denver, I'm Taylor Allen.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So we heard about video games for military recruiters. Home builders are using a new system called Sim, but that has nothing to do with the video game. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
A new way of building could be more environmentally friendly. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Dustin Albright, assistant professor of architecture at Clemson University, examines this new system.
It's no secret that building construction has lagged behind other industries when it comes to evolving. Various forms of prefabrication are addressing this gap and can offer compelling advantages for quality control, improved schedules, reduced waste, and lower costs. Our faculty and students have been developing the Simply Building Framing System since 2014 to provide a unique and nimble approach to prefab construction. The system, which was patented in 2018, utilizes prefabricated building components cut from plywood sheets by CNC routers or water jet cutters. The resulting walls, roofs, and floors are designed for easy, ready-at-hand assembly with unskilled labor and without power tools, and offer great insulating qualities for energy efficiency, plus easy coordination with mechanical and electrical systems. They have also been tested and approved for strong coastal winds and seismic zones, all while retaining the low carbon footprint of sustainably harvested wood. The system relies on plywood joinery and steel zip ties, replacing nails found in traditional construction, contributing to safer, quieter building sites. It also means a Simply structure can be disassembled quickly and non-destructively, allowing the parts to be reused. Initially developed in conjunction with the 2015 Solar Decathlon competition sponsored by the U.S. Department of Energy, the Simply system has been utilized for two houses, community arts installations, and a pop-up acoustical shell in Genoa, Italy. A demonstration structure was recently completed in Victoria, British Columbia, with the Annamora Housing Society. Our work with Simply is far from over. Our architecture students will visit Victoria in the fall as part of a design study on affordable housing typologies, and we continue to work alongside industry to offer Simply as a solution for housing and disaster relief.
That was Dustin Albright of Clemson University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.
Thank you.